This is Democracy,
a podcast that explores the interracial, intergenerational, and intersectional
unheard voices living in the world's
most influential democracy.
Welcome to our post-election episode of This is Democracy. I know all of our listeners have been up very late the last few nights. And after our discussion of the power of voting and the importance of voting in our last episode, today we're going to talk about what it means and the outcome of this recent election. We have with us two of the most detailed and insightful thinkers on this topic that I know. My colleague Jim Henson of the Texas Politics Project, he's the director of that, and Brian Jones, who is a distinguished entrepreneur and one of the leaders of Stand Up Republic, which has been one of the most important organizations in getting more people involved in politics, particularly independents. So to start us off, Zachary has a poem about election night. Zachary, what's your poem titled?
If Mississippi is close.
If Mississippi is close. Okay, Zachary, let's hear it.
8 p.m., I watch the votes come in from Indiana, flood through the gates like water. The Kentucky ballots counted, but I don't want to care. 9 p.m., I couldn't believe they called it for Cruz with only 30% in. Didn't think they actually meant it. 10 p.m., and it finally sunk in, leaning against the railing, staring at the projected newscast in disbelief out of it. 10:30, trying to be hopeful. When the night is good, the stars are bright, but the one you wanted most to see is gone. Hugging the great column of the old hotel, sliding around its smooth surface in agitation. 11 p.m., and I still don't think any of it matters. The House districts coming in from Minnesota, Oklahoma to cheers, but it doesn't sink in until they call Mississippi a tie. If Mississippi is close, then I can sleep soundly. 11:30, watching him concede from a time zone away, 9 hours as the crow flies, cheering inside my head, lost in the emotion, I just sit staring when it's time to go. 12:30, and I'm sleeping for an early rise.
So it sounds like your poem is about the emotional swings of election night. How did you feel? How does your poem capture that?
Well, it talks about how, like, some candidates that you really want to win don't win, but then some that you don't expect to win win, and it's really a swing. And especially after, like, all the stress of not knowing what's going to happen, and then it finally happens, and it's hard to make sense of it when it first happens.
Right, right, right. And they're mixed results, right? Well, that's a good point for us to go to our experts here. Brian, you were following this, obviously, very closely. What should we make of the results?
You know, I think one of the best lines that I read about the evening was it was kind of a choose your own adventure of the news that you wanted, where almost whatever way you wanted to interpret the results, you could spin it to your base. You know, the Senate is going to go farther right by at least 2, depending on what happens in a couple of the Senate races that are still under recounts. But I think the D's picking up 37 at this point, like that's a, you know, as much as at the beginning of the news cycle, there was a lot of, oh, well, you know, this is not going to be a blue wave. And even after a lot of the results were coming in, people were saying, well, you know, this is what they were expected to do. Picking up 37 seats in a midterm election is almost unprecedented. Like, it is as high of a turnover as you've seen. I think last time was 06, and right, the way that George Bush characterized that was a thumping.
Right.
And so you have a situation where there is a big change. And so, you know, you saw some really interesting things happen nationwide where, you know, I think the right did end up going a little bit farther right. I think the Republican caucus is probably more Trumpian in nature now because I do think a lot of the moderates lost their elections. I'm glad that there are still some moderates, but I think that with everything that's happened recently, having the House be blue and having some congressional oversight on the executive branch is a great thing.
Right. So we will actually have mixed government now.
We will. And having, you know, having Adam Schiff and Eddie Johnson involved as being chair people of their committees, like that's a pretty big change as it relates to this kind of bicameral governance.
Gotcha. Jim, is that accurate for thinking about Texas in particular?
Well, I mean, I think Texas fits into that mosaic in an interesting way. I mean, Texas isn't like the deeper red states, and it's hard to remember that, I think, in some
right.
ways. That
right.
just went, you know, a place like North Dakota where Heidi Heitkamp lost, in the Senate race, you know, what we saw in many of those states was, you know, the red states getting redder, and we didn't see that in Texas.
Right.
I mean, in Texas, we saw a different dynamic, and I think because Texas is different,
right.
You know, in a lot of important ways that are fairly obvious. I mean, we're bigger. We're most importantly, we're more urban. Mm-hmm. Even if we do have a foundational kind of conservative political culture that, in my view, promises that we're likely to get more competitive, but never quite turn blue. And I think reasonable people can disagree about that. But
so I
think what we saw, because Texas is so big and so varied, was almost a microcosm of what we saw in the country overall, where Democrats extended their urban dominance in Texas out into critical areas of the suburbs. But the Republican Party was able to maintain, you know, more shakily this time, their overall dominance in the rural and kind of exurban areas and the farther reaches of the city. Mm-hmm. And in an interesting way, you know, people, there's all this lore about Texas being separate from the rest of the country. And I always, you know, laugh and, you know, it's a reliable laugh line in talks to say, I'm here to remind you, Texas is part of the United States.
Right, right.
And in some ways, you know, Tuesday night, Texas looked like a microcosm of the country.
Right. Or even a bellwether in certain ways, right?
Yeah, maybe, you know, maybe. I mean, I think that's a little more complicated, but yes.
Right. So Brian was referring to sort of divided government or mixed government. Are we going to see something more like that in Texas?
Well, not right away. Certainly not, you know, you know, we were talking before the podcast started, you know, what we saw was an erosion of the advantage that the Republican Party holds, particularly in the lower chamber of the state house, where the Republican Party flipped no Democratic seats. And in fact, the Democratic seats that were supposed to be, there were only one or two that were supposed to be in danger. The Democratic incumbents won large. On the other side, the Democrats flipped 12 seats from Republican. So from Republican to Democrat, you still have a pretty big majority in the House, but there are signs of attrition. And on the statewide ballot, what you saw were lower victory margins for all of the Republican statewide officials. Everybody escaped Democratic challenges. Obviously, most prominently, Ted Cruz, who beat Beto O'Rourke, but only by 3 points. So we're not at the point where we're seeing institutional signs of institutional progress, but I'm working on a piece right now that you can kind of see a more competitive party system on the horizon.
Right, right. And Brian, do you think that these competitive races are going to have an immediate effect on policymaking?
I absolutely hope so. I think part of where I think that we've gotten is that things have become so polarizing and so partisan and so essentially tribal when you think about issues. And if you know that to get reelected the next time, you're going to have a more moderate view, just going and playing up to the base and the red meat offerings of going extreme on a issue, I'm hopeful that that comes back and people remember that, you know, it's not just that they're trying to get a small portion of the populace to vote for them and agree with them, but it's actually that they're representing the entirety of the voting populace that elected them. And if that's the case and we can remember that and it does become more competitive, I think that you start to have a little bit different policy, and especially as it relates to restoring some of the norms and protecting the ideals that make the United States and Texas so great.
And are those the kinds of Democrats who were elected?
I think so. I think if you look nationally, that the hardcore sides on both sides had a really rough night. And I think that that's a good thing. It'll be interesting. You know, there's a couple of things from a national macro perspective that'll be really interesting to watch as well, that I don't think are making as much of an impact today as they will in 2-4 years. But, you know, Michigan passed a overwhelming modification to voter rights.
Mm-hmm.
Florida passed a Prop 4 that reinstored disenfranchised felons to having the right to vote.
Right, and that's hundreds of thousands
of
voters.
I think 1.3 million voters.
Wow.
And so, you know, between those two things, I think that, you know, there's some macro trends that are really interesting. And quite honestly, I hope that more states do what Michigan did and make it easier for people to vote. You know, listening to the last podcast about how difficult, you know, and how important it is to vote, you know, we really should be trying to make it where, you know, and I think We had 114 million people nationwide vote. You know, I think it was the highest percentage since 1970. I think Texas had 52.7, something like that, percent vote.
Yeah, I think that's about right.
So, you know, people showed up for the first time in a big drove. But if we could make that where it was even easier to vote,
right,
and get more people out there, I think that hopefully that continues to see the trend of moving people towards what we see as kind of these moderate individuals, right, that are still passionate about their issues,
right,
but able to understand that there is nuance and not just a binary outcome.
Right. Jim, do you agree? Do you see us moving in that direction?
Well, I mean, I think progress is uneven. We were talking about the, you know, I've been a professional wet blanket for the last couple of months, and I'm still maybe having trouble shifting gears. But no, I mean, look, I think that the things that Brian is talking about are important developments. They're moving in the right direction. I think there's still a bit of sorting out to do, yes, as we see how people behave and what is clearly going to continue to be a very partisan, geographically divided. I mean, tribal is the word we're hearing a lot now. I'm not, you know, I kind of go in and out about using that. But I do think that there's a long conversation to be had that's been going on and is gaining momentum about making it easier to vote, about revisiting some of our institutional practices like redistricting that, you know, maybe have, you know, gotten a little bit long in the tooth in terms, right, of our set, right, arrangements, and that there are ways of doing that. You know, there are arguments for that, but I think it is still an argument as we're, mm-hmm, seeing in Georgia right now.
Right.
I mean,
absolutely.
Georgia in some ways is the most rarefied example of just how hard that discussion can be, particularly in certain parts of the country and in certain partisan environments.
Right, right. And of course, as our listeners know, this is an old story. This is actually part of our history. We inherit this. This is not something new right now. Jim, what about the new kinds of voters and the new kinds of people in office, especially at the local level? Does that make a difference?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does. I mean, particularly in states that have been lopsided, whether Democratic or Republican, I think, you know, local offices where you recruit candidates and where candidates actually learn about governance and civic engagement at the ground level. To my mind, not to single anybody out, but in an age where we're looking for celebrities to solve our problems, I'm one of these guys. You know, I love mayoral candidates,
yes,
for example.
Yes.
I have a bias. I mean, it's almost a bias I have to control. You know, yes, when I see a mayor running for office, I see somebody that has run things, knows how things work, has had to make compromises in and settle almost habitually by definition for,
right,
things they don't want. And so, yeah, I think in particular, I think those local channels are vital to us getting a little bit back on track,
right,
frankly.
Right. I mean, and those are the spaces where people are actually doing the bipartisan problem solving.
Because they have to.
Yeah. They have to. Brian, do you see this having a deep effect on the presidential election coming up in 2020?
I think it is going to be really hard to say right now. I do think that there were some very positive signs that the nation is thinking about things differently. You know, I think for the first time, there's over 100 women that are going to be in Congress.
That's
the first two Muslim women ever were elected.
Right.
Texas, I think, is sending its first Latina, and I think there's two of them that are going to Congress. So the diversity of our representatives is increasing, and I think that's a good thing. But I think that also is something that is going to cause some consternation among the voting populace as well. I think,
right,
that there's a very big split right now between voting for what is best for the country and voting for what is best for me.
Right.
And I think that that's really playing out in the way that the elections are being talked about, where there is a lot of change happening in the United States right now. And you are really being asked, do you want to protect what has always kind of been the way that it was or the way that we're heading?
Right.
And to sit there and say, you know, this 2 years out gives us an insight, I think it's a little bit early. I do think that, you know, the Midwest, where 7 of the 8 major races in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Indiana went blue, I think is really interesting. I think, you know, Florida is always going to be interesting,
right,
just in the fact that almost, I was really surprised that they passed Prop 4, because every election that I've ever seen in Florida is, you know, 50.01, 49.99.
Right.
Like, they can't vote for a majority on almost anything. So, and that's where, you know, to get the Electoral College becomes really interesting, because you have to carry either the Midwest belt or pick up Florida. And now it's going to be what happens over the next 2 years and what happens. But I do think the next 2 years are going to be really important, not only for the presidential election, but going back to the gerrymandered districts, you know, there was a lot of local houses and Senate, state houses and state senates that flipped. And if they're in control of gerrymandering, maybe there's an opportunity to make it where it is less partisan and more committee driven to say, let's come up with something that is as fair as we could possibly get.
Right, right.
Jeremy, I get too far in the weeds, but with this point about the two Latina representatives really brings a lot of things together that we've already talked about, because on one hand, they are, you know, these are Democratic seats, they're new, but they're new members that are replacing, you know, O'Rourke in one case and Jean Green, a longtime liberal from the urban area, but they're also experienced local officials. Both Farhana Escobar and Sylvia Garcia came up through local government.
Just as he was speaking before.
Exactly. So they're both that channel, and but they're also sort of a different kind of representative than we're seeing kind of dominating the news cycles and the discussion. You were talking about some of the more kind of people from the more, you know, sort of progressive wing of the Democratic Party. Both Escobar and Garcia will be, you know, relatively on the, you know, to the left of the Democratic Party, but they're really not part of this new kind of quote unquote new breed of candidate that just jumped in because they were angry about Donald Trump or energized now. These are people that have been engaged in politics and worked up through this, you know, within the system for the last decade or more.
And they're likely to work well with Nancy Pelosi, in fact, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're going to, you know, they're not going to be, they'll be new to Congress, and that's a move up, but they're not going to be green.
There is a very youth driven, like in politics, obviously youth in air quotes, because it's not necessarily these are young people, but they're new. And especially what we've seen over the last 15 years in federal politics is that, you know, people haven't stepped down. So the average age of our representatives has inched up, and especially on national elections, so presidential elections, the candidates have been becoming older and older. And I do think that some of the excitement that we saw for some of the candidates, Beto and others, is that there's this youthful rise of saying, okay, the next generation of leaders is coming. And I think that's inspiring, where it's not just the same people, but it's new faces, new energy coming up.
Absolutely. And new faces in terms of diversity, and certainly in terms of youth. What a lot of students ask me, Jim, is how they can make sense of what look like two contradictory phenomena. Right. On the one hand, there's this positive story, right, of new kinds of people who represent different communities, Latina, African-American, women, more than 100 women in Congress now. On the other hand, there's so much more evidence of racism. It's hard to look at the Florida race without thinking that in the end, the fact that Andrew Gillum was African-American cost him, even though he was ahead in the polls, right, to look at the race in Georgia. And then, you know, those who won in Texas as well. So how do we make sense of this? How are we becoming more racist and less racist at the same time?
Well, I mean, I think we have to remember that there's the underlying structure, and then there's what's revealed and what we see in front of us. And I also think that, you know, the essence of what we're seeing, frankly, in the White House right now, and the movement that has gathered and is most enthusiastic about Donald Trump, you know, is a very reactive movement, and it's been pent up, and it's reactive against much of the progress that we've made in the country in the last 50 or 60 years. And I think that, you know, I'm very influenced and kind of persuaded by the political philosopher Corey Robbins' understanding of what is most continuous about the heart of the most conservative of our politics, and that it is a reaction against political change and the challenge to hierarchies.
Right. Right.
And I think we're in the middle of a pushback that was given voice and energized but not started by the current president.
Right.
And I think the president, this is one of those areas where as much as Donald Trump in the White House is an active agent now that he's there, this is an area in which Donald Trump was not the cause of anything.
Right.
He was the effect.
Right.
And so I think that's when students ask me about that, that's what I say, is that, you know, these are things that were unresolved issues, and it's an ongoing process to, you know, whatever figure of speech you want to use, whether it's the perfectibility of the Constitution or the way that liberalism develops over time.
It's protean character.
Yes, exactly. You know, choose your metaphor, right? Or choose your figure of speech. That's where those contradictions come from.
Yeah.
That's what propel they,
yeah.
and those things that seem like contradictions, those tensions are what propel us.
Right.
That propulsive force meets resistance, and that's where we are right now, in my view.
And I also don't think that the percentage of people that fall into that racist camp is actually relatively small. The problem that we have right now is that they have been empowered to become vocal.
Right.
And they are taking advantage of that. And I think Gillum had a great line where, I'm not saying that you're racist, I'm saying the racist believe that you are.
Right.
And I think that was a spot on line, because you see people like David Duke all of a sudden coming back out from the rock that they live under and making comments and endorsing policies.
Sure.
And encouraging their base, albeit small, to step up and become vocal and loud and cause issues. And I think that does skew a lot of things, because I don't think that, you know, I do think that there are big macro changes beyond racism that are causing the Republican Party to try to figure out what its identity is.
And I'm sure it's correct, as both of you said, that this is a relatively small group that's expressing these extreme views. But I think the concern many have, right, is that our political structure has disproportionately empowered that. And so that's really the question I wanted us to close on, because I think it's the big question, right? Did the results in this election give us reason to believe that our political structure is adjusting to empower other voices rather than these minority voices that have seemed to hijack our politics for the last few years? Or should we expect ourselves to be still stuck in this space? And how should we think about that?
Yes. I'm on a small email list with a group of, you know, aging white liberals who have played poker together for 20 years. And one of the more dour among us Wednesday morning was really down. He was just saying, I see that that there's been some change, but I still feel like I'm poised over the abyss.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and what I basically said was, you know, the best I think I can tell you is that you are still poised over the abyss, but yesterday we gained a guardrail.
Yes.
It's a little less likely that, you know, you're either going to be tempted to just leap or that you're going to accidentally fall. Yeah. That's the way to kind of think about these results. And so I think, you know, institutions, you know, you're a historian, tend to adjust more often than not slowly.
Absolutely.
With a lag.
Absolutely.
And I think, you know, I would be much more worried had things shifted in such a way, or our projections had been so off,
right,
that somehow the Democrats didn't take hold of the Congress or of the House of Representatives. And I say that not because, you know, I think the Democrats are going to save democracy, but because I think that institutional foothold is really critical at this time.
Absolutely.
And I don't expect it to be miraculous, but I do expect it to blunt some of the things, you know, some of the more negative things that we've been talking about.
Right. That makes sense. Brian?
One of the board members of Stand Up Ideas, our sister organization, is Yasha Monk. And Yasha has become an expert on authoritarian governments.
Right.
And his comment was that, you know, that's not the first election, it's the response. It's the second election. Do you fall further into authoritarian government, or do you repudiate it in some extent? And I think, you know, nationally being a plus seven, plus eight for the Ds, the exit polls being that 55% of the populace is not happy with either direction or with President Trump, I think shows that the institutions to some extent are reacting to an authoritarian government, and saying that it's time for change and wanting that check in the checks and balances to be there. I think that there's going to be, you know, I don't think that this is something that, again, is going to be resolved immediately. I do think that there's going to be a lot of fights that go forward. You know, even yesterday with the firing of Sessions,
right.
The revoking of a CNN reporter's White House access, you know, you've already seen within 24 hours two major, almost constitutional crises.
Right.
So I think it'll be interesting. And I think that there are going to be some things that, as we continue to look at the evolution of our democracy, how things play out. You know, I do think that the way that the primaries are set up is that we end up with very polarizing individuals.
Sure.
I think on the last podcast, one of the comments was that they felt like they were choosing between the lesser of two evils.
That's right.
Or that they had and I think that that's an outcome of the way that we are designed right now. And some of the changes that California and New Hampshire and Michigan are looking at to have, you know, choice ranked ballots,
yep,
or to have jungle primaries where all of a sudden some of these things may change. I think that those are the things that we're going to need to continue to look at as we evolve. But I do think that, you know, as an ecosystem, we at least reacted to what's happening,
yep,
and started to try to figure out how do we get back to where we should be.
I think these are such great insights. As a historian, I'll just add that the historical record leads us to believe people don't change their votes very often. What makes a difference is when new voters come in. And I think what makes me very optimistic as a historian is to see all of these new voters. You both talked about this, and new kinds of candidates. And of course, they didn't transform the system overnight, but they certainly made a huge difference. Take a state like Wisconsin, where a new governor is elected with about 30,000 votes, and a lot of that is a 93% turnout in Dane County, which is the youngest, most educated county in Wisconsin. And so it does seem to me we're on the edge of what is probably another civil rights movement of new voters coming in and making a difference. Zachary, what do you think? How are your friends and your age cohort looking?
I agree with that, but I also think it's a little... I think there's some people who voted for Trump and are willing to vote for Democrats for Congress, but I'm not sure if they're going to be willing to vote against Trump in 2020. I think that's a little worrying. But also, I agree that there's a very small minority that are really racist and are voting for Trump because of that. But the problem is there are a lot of people who are willing to overlook that and overlook that support and that base just to help themselves. And I'm not sure if this was as big enough of a wave against that to really be heartening.
But are young people, your friends, excited and optimistic or pessimistic?
I think a bit of both. I think they're optimistic about the next 2 years and really uncertain about what's going to happen after that.
Well, that probably characterizes how most of us think. Jim, Brian, Zachary, thank you so much for your insights. Thank you for joining us on This Is Democracy.
This podcast is produced by the Liberal Arts Development Studio and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.
The music in this episode was written and recorded by Harrison Lemke, and you can find his music at harrisonlemke.com.
Subscribe and stay tuned for a new episode every Thursday featuring new perspectives on democracy.